Number one, Star Wars. Number two, comics. Number three, Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. Number four, Mario. Number five, Weird Al. Number six, Batman. Number seven, Kal-El. Number eight, The Simpsons. Number nine, TV. Number ten, every single band that I stole all their MP3s, but before they all sold out, say it all together if you're with me now. Nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything. Say nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything. Say nerds ruin everything.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Nerds Ruin Everything. I'm Logan.
And I'm Adam.
And we're going to talk about some trailers, and, well, at least one trailer. Some what we've been watching, specifically what Adam's been watching. And for the first time in a number of weeks, we both went to the theater and saw the exact same movie. So that's going to be fun. But I don't think there's any news of consequence. I saw some more Blade news, but like at this point, I don't really even care.
Like, yeah, it's been such a troublesome, project for Marvel, which I don't understand how
it's
hard.
So
it is.
Weird. How much trouble this movie has been.
It's very weird because, okay, so like, here's the thing. I just saw a kick-ass vampire movie over the weekend. I watched Abigail, and that fucking movie rocks really hard and does.
Is it the Radio Silence guys?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yes,
okay.
It is. I will tell you this much. Thank God they got out of the Scream loop because, like, that was doing them no favors. Like, it caused me to go back to watch Scream in Manhattan, and I was not a fan of that movie. Like I did myself a dishonor this weekend by watching two. Like, I really didn't like that movie in any way, shape, or form. Like, it felt like I'm glad that they were forced out of it because I feel like it begat Abigail. Like, they made Abigail this little, like, this child vampire movie that's probably one of the better vampire movies I've seen in a long time because of how inventive it is with the storytelling. Watching Scream in Manhattan, I hadn't seen it. So, like, I went to watch it and
I forgot you hadn't watched it.
Yeah, it's not. Okay, so, like, the last 20 minutes is okay, it's like there, it moves in fits and starts for me, but it's so much ingrained in the script that it just isn't very clever. Like, neither of their movies, like, okay, so like, this is my problem with the Radio Silence guys with Scream is that they're, it's not as like, their two Scream movies are not anywhere close to being as clever as both Ready or Not and Abigail are. Like, both of those, like it feels like Radio Silence wasn't in control in Scream, and they were just told, direct the script that you got. So, and they do a great job.
I think their first one, like, they get a little bit of, like, leeway, and it shows. Mm-hmm. I honestly think, like, if you dig into the second one, I think that they had a different script with different ideas that they weren't able to get who they wanted to get. I really think the idea was to bring Matthew Lillard back.
Yeah, that's what it really does feel like. And when he was like, when that just didn't happen, it loses, like, it really does, like,
it loses You have the issue that a lot of people had. They were expecting that, and yeah, when it doesn't happen, it loses a lot of steam when you get the reveal, and it's like, oh, this, it's in a weird way, it feels a lot like Scream 2.
Yes, which it really does.
For me, like, Scream 1, super inventive. Scream 2 feels like a weird, like, it is a retread, but, like, not in a fun way. not in a, like, Back to the Future 2 kind of way, you know?
No, absolutely.
It's just, like, oh, yeah, this, like, that feels like a retread and really convoluted for no reason. And then Scream 3 feels like this, we're going to play with the format, like, outside the box kind of thing, like, movie in a movie. You know, it's fun. It's maybe not super inventive, but it's fun. But yeah, you're not the only one that had, but I had fun with it. Uh-huh. But I definitely think their first one is the better of the two. But I'm with you, like, getting caught in that bubble, probably not good for them. going back to doing their own stuff is, you know, probably gonna, you know, at least give them more opportunity to take the chances that they want to take.
Absolutely. No, you're right. You're 100%. Like, I didn't really, like, so, like, I went, like, I would, like, you know, I always make notes about things, and especially what other people say about films to me. And it's not, like, this weird petty thing. It's just literally just trying to remember certain things that people were reminding me of. And one of the big things that you had told me about Scream in Manhattan, because I refuse to call it Scream 6, it's literally Jason Takes Manhattan. Like, that, I think that's the more disappointing thing to me is that, like you said, like, okay, so, like, you just posted something on the site talking about Back to the Future 2, which I think that the reason why I bonded with both you and Ryan was that you guys had, like, it's one of the first things I had a conversation with Ryan about, which is that the greatest sequel of all time is Back to the Future 2, because it bucks all the conventions of a sequel, but also dives into those conventions without, it's the first meta sequel that you've ever, like, that's ever been produced, but it makes perfect sense after all the bullshit that, like, Back to the Future 2 was never supposed to happen, right? It was just a, like, the tag at the end.
To be continued as a joke. Like, joke. It's an absolute joke.
Exactly. And that was, like, Zemeckis was, like, the Kevin Williamson of the 80s, right? Like people don't realize that. He was so meta before, like, what I feel like has been lost in the last 20 years about Robert Zemeckis is just how inventive of a storyteller he was. Like, how ahead of the curve. You look at Used Cars, that's a movie that's super ahead of its time. It's like 15, like, if he had made it in 95 or 97, that would have been the start of, like, that kind of raunchy ensemble comedy, right? But he misses the boat by 15 years. 15 fucking years. Like, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which comes right before Back to the Future, is, like, the ultimate meta commentary on, like, even more so now than it was when it was released 30 years ago. It's a commentary on, like, how we view films and how we view, like, movies and how we ingest movies and audience members. Like Eddie Valiant is literally old man movie filmmaker that hates everything but the old ways. It's very interesting how Zemeckis, like, was, like, the first, like, you know, smart ass filmmaker, like, you know, like, that's what I feel like. And, like, I feel like after Roger Rabbit, he wanted to do more and he got forced into this box. He got pressured by Spielberg and by Universal and by Amblin, and him and Bob Gale just went, oh, you want a fucking sequel? We'll give you a sequel. And gave us the most, like I said, like the most meta sequel of all time. That's kind of what I wanted from Scream 2 that I never got. And it's really what I wanted the Radio Silence guys to do with Scream that never happened, right? It, like, but it's absolutely in their wheelhouse to do what's, like, I will pose this. Radio Silence is the new millennia version of Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale. Because they are so smartassy about their concepts when they're allowed to do it, right? Like, when they're, like, Ready or Not is, like, both a murder mystery, a princess movie, and a, you know, and a, like, a man is hunted movie, all rolled into one, but done and flipped over and sideways to where it's so inventive that you're watching something kind of new. And Abigail is like, takes the vampire tropes and eats itself alive. Like, in the same kind of smart-assy way that happens. And, like, that's what I wanted from Scream Manhattan. I'm like, okay, guys, show me. And then they were building to that, like, what you were saying with the Matthew Lillard reveal. And I hadn't read anything, so I didn't know. But I remembered exactly what you told me, which is that it builds up to something that you think is going to happen. And when it doesn't and the reveal happens, you're so disappointed. And I was.
Yeah.
I mean, you were 100% right. You know me very well, know me well enough to know that if it's something like that and you're going to deliver, don't go right or left. Go right into the center of it.
I also think it doesn't, like, I get that you have to make the movie feel small, but, like, you set it in New York City, and you make New York City feel like it's tiny, and it's just, it's not. But, I definitely get not enjoying the movie. I think at this point I'm with Scream. It's one of the, like, handful of horror franchises that I will just be like, okay, I know I can watch this and it's not gonna suck beyond belief, and it's also not gonna give me fucking nightmares, which left turn. Yeah, when I went to go see the movie last night, they showed the trailer for the Strangers,
the new Strangers God, movie. Yes.
Holy shit, man.
You know who's directed by?
Rennie Harlan.
All three of them. There's three of them that he's making, and he's made them all already. And literally, Rennie Harlan has made a movie that, like, I'm literally genuinely excited about. And, like, that looks frightening. It really does look like the original, right?
The first one fucking terrified me. Like... I did not think, like, I'm not the biggest horror movie guy, but I was like, I can do this. Like, you know, it's not, you know, possessed children. So, like, it's not going to give me any kind of, like, fucked up dreams. So, like, I'll go see this. And, like, the first one absolutely terrified me. And so, like, I remember reading that they were making another one. And when I saw the trailer last night, I was like, holy shit. And then I looked it up and I was like, oh, what, Rennie Harlan? Like, holy cow. Like, the guy has not, it's not that he hasn't been active, because he certainly has. It's just that he hasn't been able to get like an actual movie in theaters in decades. I mean,
he's been in
Exorcist. Okay, so, the Beginning was the last, like, shot that I remember.
Like, he, I think it's like, and that's almost 20 years ago to the day. And it's also because he's been making movies in China. Like, if you look at his output, he's been making, like, these weird, like, English language, half Chinese, like, action films in China, or in, like, you know, like, he's not based in China. He's based in Taiwan. Like, the only reason why I know this is because I've been following him. And then whenever he does an English language thing, like a true blue English language and not just like a Chinese, like, made movie or financed movie, it's direct to video, second, like, what, like second rate. Like, it's like movies like called The Bricklayer, starring Aaron Eckhart. Like, that's the kind of shit that he does. Right. To see him go, like, it's smart though, like, go low budget horror movie, but like a brand, Like it reeks of, like, I mean, he did Nightmare. Like, he did the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, right? Like, he did, what was it, 4? Was it, like, the Dream Child, I think he did?
Yeah, one of the Dream ones. I don't...
Yeah. The Dream Master. That's the one that he did.
Yeah.
He did the one right after Dream Warriors, which is my favorite. And he was settled with the fact that he didn't get... what's her name? Patricia Arquette. Like, Patricia Arquette wasn't in the movie. He had to use somebody else, like a replacement actress. But yeah, that and Mindhunters, I think, were The Exorcist and Mindhunters were the last two movies that he released in theaters. So imagine the surprise that he's literally going back to his roots and making like a low budget. It looks like a low budget, like, you know, it's Ren Harlan.
That's definitely the appeal of a movie like that, is that, like, other than, like, possible gore factor, like, which won't be too heavy because you're only dealing with a couple of people. Like, you know, other than location, like, it's a very Blair Witch kind of approach, you know.
Very much.
Very so. Low budget. Not, you know, $50,000 low budget, but.
No.
You know, it with like the marketing for the movie probably costs more than the movie.
Oh, so, God, yes. Like, but, I guarantee you the movie is like a $2 million movie. But with a one location movie, like, you know, $2 to $5 million, you can do a lot. Like, you know, that's not even low budget anymore. Like, you know, there are some movies out there that are like on the low, like what Hollywood considers low budget now is like $500,000. It used to be like an independent production would get $2 or $3 million. Like a movie like that would get like a nice amount. Now, no more, because, you know, because they're using all of the money and all the profits to incentivize an asshole like David Zaslav.
You sent it to me. I didn't even respond to it. Like, I looked at it, and it made my stomach hurt. And I meant to text you back, and I was just like, fuck that guy, man. Like, oh, my God.
Seriously.
I know we've been saying it for a year and a half now, but oh, my God. Like, just, we don't even have to get into it. Just... You can Google, like, what Zaslav is going to make, and it's disgusting.
Yep.
Like,
it really is. There's no reason for this man to make the kind of money that he's making when, literally his company is going, like, his company is losing money. Like, that's the thing, is that they want, like, that's the thing that doesn't make sense to me. It's like, okay, so he lost money. So he, like, his company lost money in a big way. He should not be incentivized for that.
No.
Like, no one should be. You actually should be giving money back. Like, no, like billionaire, you kind of fucked this up. You know, people busted their asses and you just decided, like, what? Like, you think that you earned this? Oh, man, I fucking hate him so much, man. Like, when I heard the number, and guys, we're not going to talk about it any more than that. I just made a joke about it, but, like, yeah, like, but anyway. Yeah,
it's disgusting.
It really is.
All right, so speaking of people who probably get paid too much to do what they do, you got to see part two of Netflix Give Zack Snyder Too Much Money.
Rebel Moon, Rebel Moon Part 2, The Scar Giver. Like, that is a hell of a title, right? It wasn't even morbid curiosity. It was literally like, okay, I started this part one bullshit. Let's see if I can get through part two and see if there's anything more to this than what was given to us in the trailer for this movie. And there's nothing. It's literally like, I don't have anything nice or complimentary to say about this movie. Like, it's, if you liked the first one, man, buckle up. You're going to love the second one. It's has the same sort of like wasted talent like that the first one had, but like, okay, so like, here's my thing. Like, instead of making this like 2-part, 4.5-hour movie, like our combined 4.5-hour movie, why not just be original and make a 2.5, 2:45 big action epic, which this could have been. Like, literally, there's chunks here. Okay, so, like, literally, there is a campfire 30-minute scene in a 2-hour movie where each of the heroes talks about why they hate the Empire. I'm sorry, I don't even know what it's called. I'm going to call it the Empire because it's literally Zack Snyder's R-rated Star Wars movie, and I'm very glad. Like, you know, Kathleen Kennedy gets a lot of shit, but her saying fuck you to this $350 million madness that he was trying to, like, he was trying to fix upon the Star Wars universe, it would have been a blight. It literally would have done the same thing that, you know, that his DC, like, plan had done to DC, right? It just, it's like, it, there's this 30-minute, like, literally, it stops dead in its tracks, and each of the characters, each of the 8 samurai or 7 samurai that they have, like, tells their sad, sob story about why they hated the Empire and what made it so bad. Like, I ain't got nothing for this. Like, I'm not gonna, like, it's not like I'm not gonna viciously attack it because it's too boring for that. Yeah, like,
I'm never going to watch either one of them. But like, I just seeing the trailer, you know, when it starts to play on Netflix, it feels like looking at it, I'm like, you spent all that money on that?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it might look pretty good, like with the effects work and everything, but it feels like you spent a lot of money on a copycat. Like, and I know these things still exist, but it seemed more prevalent when we were younger, these copycat type movies that are like direct to video and the meant to be like, yeah, you can't get, you know, Star Wars right now, but here's this movie or whatever.
Battle,
you know?
Beyond the Stars, yeah. Ice Pirates.
Yeah.
Yeah. Much more entertaining versions. This is the boring.
They didn't cost what Star Wars cost to make.
No, they cost $2, you know, like Ice Pirates or Battle Beyond the Stars or whatever Roger Corman ripoff. They were shot on film, but they were like, okay, I'm a huge fan of those ripoff films, right? Like those 80s ripoff films, like the biggest ones were the Conan ones, right? As soon as Conan was released.
So much like, here's a buff blonde dude with no shirt on roaming the desert. Like,
but always the desert.
Yeah, but they felt original enough, even though, you know, it's like, oh yeah, if Conan hadn't been successful, we would have never gotten Mark Singer as the Beastmaster.
Oh, but, hell no, yeah.
But I like the Beastmaster, like,
I like the Beastmaster, too. I like Tawny Katane a lot. But, you know, you're right. Like, it's that thing of, like, the Beastmaster is original enough and has, like, some wild-ass shit. Like, my favorite part of Beastmaster is, okay, so Conan had James Earl Jones. We have Rip Torn. Where the fuck is the analogy there? Like, how is that analogy? Like, where's that, like, voice? Like, oh, he has kind of like a weird.
They had, what's his name? The dad from Good Times. John Amos. Oh, shit.
Yeah, John Amos. John Amos. Yeah. As the Lando character. Like not even like they go straight to start. Like, they mix and match their fucking things because, like, Mark Singer is literally playing both Luke Skywalker and Han Solo, right? Yeah. But John Amos is playing Lando and C-3PO at the same time. Like it's so fucking wild, that movie. I love that. I have that on 4K. Like, I love that fucking movie. I love Beastmaster. I do not love Rebel Moon or anything it has to, like, anything done with it. And you know what? Like, I don't even know who this is for. Like I don't, like, I honestly don't even
Zack
know. Like,
Snyder fans.
But how many are there? Like, it does, is there enough to justify a $300 million budget for two movies? Like,
we have not had a Star Wars film in 5 years.
Yep.
And Zack Snyder has made two of these movies.
Yes.
So, I mean, while I'm with you on Kathleen Kennedy, like, shutting his shit down and being like, yeah, this isn't for Star Wars. But, like, also, they can't seem to get a Star Wars movie off the fucking ground. So,
no, like, they can't.
It's mind blowing.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just going to say it, like, if you liked the first one and you thought I was wrong, go ahead and watch the second one. I'm not stopping you. No one's stopping you. Right. Like, ultimately, that's my whole thing is, like, you know what? You like what you like. I really didn't fucking like this movie. It's a waste of time to me. It's a waste of resources and budget. Like, I think I texted you. I was like, you know, the real crime against humanity, like, against cinematic humanity, is the fact that Jaimon Hunsu is giving his all in something that doesn't deserve his all. Like, literally, this man is the heart and soul of this fucking movie. And he's like the fifth lead.
He must feel some kind of kinship with Zack Snyder. Like,
he has to,
you know?
Yeah.
So,
like most of these people, like, who are returning, they have to have, like, in all intents and purposes, I've heard he's a very, very, very congenial man. He's a very nice man. Like, everything I've heard about him is that you would think that he's like his fandom, but he is not like his fandom. Like, he's very personable. He likes he's the one, like, here's the thing, is that he's the one that brought Ray Fisher back. Like, he was the one that, like, continues to work with Ray Fisher.
It says a lot that Ray Fisher is in these movies. Like, yeah. You know, it kind of, it's in a weird way, it further solidifies, like, way further solidifies exactly what Ray Fisher was saying. Yeah. Like,
100%.
There's a fucking problem because this dude spoke up. And now he can't get work.
Yeah. And, like, here's the thing. They will get my view. Like, and I know this sounds weird, but I'm for that kind of stuff. And that's what gets me the view. That's what gets my view, right? Like, it's not going to give me 100 views, but the fact that like, Zack Snyder is like, nah, fuck you guys. Like, he got blackballed? No, that's not cool. Like, you know, he got blackballed out of the fucking, out of Hollywood and in work? No, I'm going to give him fucking work. I don't care. I don't give a shit about you guys and your fucking bullshit. That kind of stuff, like, that's the kind of thing that defines character. And
I wish he was a better filmmaker, man.
Yeah.
It would be so much easier to just be like, you know what, like, he's, you know, in a Kevin Smith kind of way, like, Smith's not a great filmmaker, but it's like, he's a good enough filmmaker in making Kevin Smith movies that it's kind of just like, well, like, he's in his corner, he's doing his own thing, he's hiring the people he wants to work with, they like working with him, they just keep doing this over and over again, like, it's cool, just, like, it's fine. Yeah. Leave him alone. Let him do his thing. Like, it's all good. But, like, he evokes some kind of toxic fandom. I mean, it's not all he evokes, but, like,
no.
There's that part of it. And also, like, I mean, if you look at his films, it's at this point, I don't even know if it's 50-50. Like good and bad?
No, it's not good and bad. It's just like, okay, so like, here's my thing is that Snyder has never been as good as he was when he had a screenwriter like James Gunn. That's the honest truth. He's like even in Watchmen, he had a screenwriter to fight. Like a screenwriter had a fight, like, you know, Alex T, like in his specific, like they made choices, right? Like they made choices with their Watchmen adaptation, whether you like it or not. Like I don't mind the theatrical cut. I actually feel like it's a very well made film. Like it's something I watched and I went, man, they made some choices here, and I don't mind the choices. I think that since then, because he's become Zack Snyder, quote unquote, and he's like, yeah, he's had screenwriters, but I mean, they're yes men. Chris Tedero is literally like Ben Affleck's friend and was brought into like the Batman v Superman. Like Goyer is going to do whatever, like he's not going to fight Snyder and Nolan, right? Like, and Nolan is basically like, yeah, do whatever you want to do with Man of Steel. I'm done here. This is just my label, right? Like, I am just the executive producer because they're forcing me into this role. And I want $20 million, you know? Like, who doesn't? And since that DC thing where he took a stranglehold on it, and, like, this is the thing I'll never forgive him for, is that he actively had said that he does not like Superman, and he took the job. Like,
we did find out this week that he's, even though he directed the movie, he okayed all of it. We did find out he's not the one responsible for the Martha line. But we found that out this week. Like, that was an interesting bit of, like, oh, yeah, the screenwriter, like, Chris, whatever the hell his name is. Yeah,
Tedero.
Yeah.
Academy Award winning.
Was like, hey, isn't it interesting that their mothers are both named Martha? And he was like, oh yeah, I never thought about that. Like, he did an interview on a podcast, and like, he was like, I don't understand why it became such a big like hot button thing, but like, it is what it is, and here's how we arrived at that decision. And I actually read one article that was like, oh, it's kind of convinced me that maybe it's not so bad after all. And I'm like, how did this convince you? Like, I totally get what they're trying to do. What they're trying to do, I thought was stupid to begin with. Not that I didn't understand why the Martha thing gave Batman pause. I understand why. It's just that I thought it was dumb.
Yep. It is. Like, it's something that you do, like, it's something that a child does. That makes them think that, like, gives them a bit of self-satisfaction, right? Like, that's the thing for me, is that it feels like when you're playing, like, hold on a second. Sorry about that. It's like when you're playing, like, action figures when you're, like, 5 years old.
Yeah.
And, like, you're like, Martha, why did you say that name? Why did you say the blah, blah, blah? Like, you feel so self-satisfied when you're a kid that you realize, oh, they're both named Martha. It's a 5-year-old's argument or a 5-year-old discovery. Like, come on. Like, Chris Tedero, like the thing is that everything I find out about Chris Tedero is that more and more, like, every little, like reveal about that development process makes me realize Ben Affleck is the one that actually liked comics. His screenwriter was like a dude bro. Like, it had no idea about anything with comics. Like, oh man, you know, they're both named Martha. That's kind of awesome, isn't it? Like, you have access to so many smart people at DC that you can go back and forth with and figure out something, right? Or you're given the access to the archives,
right? You know, Kevin's, not to bring him up again, but Kevin Smith has a story that he would tell ages and ages and ages ago about, like, coming into, like, taking meetings with studios, and, like, they're like, oh, you seem to like comics, especially post-Mallrats. Like, you seem to know a lot about comics. Like, do you want to direct one of these comic book movies? Like, what do you think? And, like, I forget who he's talking with, but it might have been the infamous Superman story.
Yeah.
And I think it is. He's like, why do you want me to write this stuff? You literally have people over here that this is all they do, is write these stories. And they're like, yeah, but that's comic book people. We need movie people. It's like, what? Like,
yeah. And then it makes no sense. No, it doesn't. But then here comes Kevin Feige, who's been hailed as a genius, but literally does exactly what you and I are talking about.
Yeah, like hey, we should do it like the comics.
Exactly. We have all these comic book guys. I mean, he even says it. Okay, my favorite documentary about the making of Marvel, like a Marvel movie, is the unfiltered, unfettered, amazing doc you probably can't get anymore. And this is why you buy physical media, because I think that it's not on the disc anymore, is the 2.5-hour documentary about the making of the original Iron Man. Because it's so unfiltered. It doesn't talk about, like, the fact that they had no script, and that they were literally improvising everything on set. It's not that unfiltered, but it's unfiltered enough to have, like, these really weird and interesting moments about, like, the way that Kevin Feige's thought process works. And if anybody were to ever, like, want to know, find that documentary. It's on the original Blu-ray release of Iron Man. It's 2.5 hours, and there's a moment, and I'll never forget it, where Kevin Feige was like, you know, guys, like, you know, like I was telling them, it was like, you know, when we were making this movie, instead of hiring designers, why am I going to hire designers? Why am I going to spend millions of dollars on that when I can put it back into the budget and call our archives, the Marvel archives, and all of the Marvel artists that we had that have been making Iron Man for decades. And it's like, that's the point. That's the genius. That's not even genius. That's just practicality. And ultimately, Hollywood, like, the more I find out, the more I know people that work in the industry, Hollywood is never about practicality. It's never about practicality. It's about bringing your friends in. It's about backhanded deals. It's about, you know, producers stealing money from productions as quickly and as quietly as they can. It's about ego. A lot of it is about ego. And the biggest thing it's about that nobody wants to talk about, it's all about sex. Like, it's all about, like, the flesh peddling. I mean, all you need to do is, like, if you think that Diddy is, like is only in the music industry, oh, I've got stories to tell you. But anyways, it's neither here nor there. That went really dark. But it goes back to the thing of, like, stupidity. Like, that's literally, it's stupidity because they're so set in their egocentric ways. Like, that's how we got Batman v Superman. Because it's like, let's get dream casting. Like, even though dream casting is nowhere near what dream casting is, like, Ben Affleck, like, that's what your dream cast is? Like, literally, you could have anybody that you want as Batman, and you chose Ben Affleck. And he brought on Chris Tedderow. He's the reason why he's there. So, like, all of the mistakes are both not just Zack Snyder, but Ben Affleck. Let's be honest here. And then, of course, Joss Whedon, because fuck that dude, too. But... yeah, man, I don't know. Like, it's weird, right? Like, if you think about it, like, if Zack Snyder was hobbled a little bit, like, they like if Netflix got some balls and said, okay, we're going to give you $200 million, but you know what we're going to do? We're going to saddle you with a screenwriter that you cannot say no to. Like, your final cuts are finally gone because you want this $300 million budget. Guess what? We're saddling you with, I don't know, Shane Black.
I mean, right? It's a problem that a lot of It's the a problem, period. Like, yeah, it's not even just a Zack Snyder issue. Like, if you look at Tarantino with Sally Minkie and Tarantino without Sally Minkie, like, there's a big difference, man. Yeah, oh, it's a big difference. You know, he's still Tarantino. Like, it's finding that right mix. We talked about it. I wrote about it when I wrote about Alien 3.
Yes.
The first three Alien movies are, like, if you watch the documentaries, the behind-the-scenes stuff, listen to the conversations, all three of those movies were fucking riddled with problems. Like, the productions were just, like, literally day-to-day, like, we might not make it through this. Like, we might get shut down. Like, we're over budget. Like, this doesn't work. That doesn't work. Like, just everything. And Alien Resurrection is not. Like, it went smooth as silk. And the movie's trash. Like, the first Star Wars movie. Like, George Lucas had a fucking, like, just, like, I don't even know, the nervous breakdown is the only.
They said he had, like, they said that he had a panic attack that was on, like, that was, like, one of those breakdown panic attacks.
Yeah.
Because they thought that he thought that he was having a heart attack. Like literally what, 2 months before the movie was supposed to be delivered,
because all the problems I had while they were filming it, you know?
Yes.
And like, it shows because
can we stop and appreciate the shittiness of British, because each one of these productions were British productions. Yeah. Can we appreciate the shittiness of, like, my favorite thing was, like, and if I ever make a movie, I don't think I'll ever go to England to make it, is the Aliens Experience by Jim Cameron and Gail Ann Hurd.
Like, oh, yeah. The crew was just like, fuck these stupid Americans coming over here. Fuck you. Like, we're not working for you. Like, and just trying to sabotage the entire film. Like, it's insane. And then, like, it goes on to be, it's cited frequently, not by me, but I get it, frequently as one of the best sequels ever made, if not the best sequel ever made. It's like Empire, The Godfather 2, Aliens.
And you're sitting here, like that tells you guys, that should tell you, like, nobody knows anything. It's just like William Goldman said, right? Like, and the fact that strife actually helps a production, like, not that kind of strife, but it does. But I mean, it's like, have somebody go against these guys. Like, you don't have to say yes to everything. Like, my favorite part, like, my favorite story, and I think that what people don't understand about what makes Spielberg brilliant is this, is that he goes into Universal. They've just spent, like, I think it was close to $10 million on Jurassic Park, the book. And he goes in to the big CEO, and the CEO says, blank check. I just need it by, he's like, I will give you a blank check and I will give you half the grosses if you can deliver this by summer of 93. And he said, okay, but here's the thing, I don't need a blank check, I'm not going to spend that, that's irresponsible, give me, and he literally said that he threw a number out of the like outside, like the highest budget that he ever had times two, which was $60 million. He's like, give me $60 million and I will deliver. And $60 million was an arbitrary number, but it became a not so arbitrary number because it constricted him. But you cannot tell me that now, 31 years later, that Jurassic Park in its original iteration isn't the bee's knees when it comes to visuals, because it still is. It's still one of the gold standards, and it's because He worked within confines. He worked within a budgetary confine, right?
George Lucas saw Jurassic Park and said, oh, we can do that now? And then decided to make the prequels.
Exactly.
100%. That's what happened.
So, like, I'm all for, like the older I get as a film fan, the more I recognize that. I mean, like, I will say this, like, Abigail having one location and $10 million as a budget was a benefit to it. Huge benefit.
It's Werner Herzog and who's the other guy that would do the, it wasn't a bet, but it was like, you have to make a movie like with these constraints.
Yes, it was their document. Like, it was Les Blank, who's a documentary filmmaker. Him and Werner Herzog had bets that they couldn't do stuff, and if they couldn't do it, and Werner Herzog couldn't, he had to eat his shoe. Had to eat his shoe. That was the bet. And like, there's a documentary on, like, the Werner, like, it's called Werner Herzog Eats His Shoe, and it's all about the bet that they made about the confines of making a movie, all for it to make it better, right? The weird eating the shoe thing is just weird.
Yeah, but it's right. Also why, like, great art comes from. It's in anything. You know, I know we're getting all philosophical, but like, it is a problem when anybody can just go in and do it their way without any kind of argument. Like, oh,
yeah,
you're a visionary. We're gonna absolutely do it the way you want to do it. Like, it doesn't always create the best work. I would say it very, very rarely creates the best work. Most directors, writers, actors probably tell you, like, I want to do this with no constraints, but not a single one of them does their best work without some kind of constraint. Like, yeah. It just doesn't happen. And yeah, like, unfortunately, much like, you know, you saw the new M. Night trailer. I didn't. But like,
yeah.
M. Night got to that point where he was like, he could just write his own ticket. Nobody was going to say boo. And like, it was all shit. Like, yep. Every single project was shit.
Yep. No, you're 100% right. And then look what happens with Split. He gets what, $3 million, and it becomes this revitalization of his career. And now he knows, like, that's the thing about M. Night, is that you watch this, it's not big budget. It looks big budget. Like, the trailer and the concept is like, it's the first time he's within shouting reach of Hitchcock. Like, it is truly a Hitchcockian story. And concept, but it looks big because he's filming it at a con. It's like takes place at a concert, but you can tell that it's still a constraint thing because it's a single location, even though it's a concert venue, right? But I feel like it's still not like a $150 million movie. It's like a $20 million movie, right?
Right.
But what you can do with $20 million, like, if you're crafty enough, is kind of brilliant. Like, watching the trailer, I was like, oh. And then what he does, the central conceit of the movie, it's like double O, because it's inventive. It's taking the constraints of what the limitations that you have, that box, that sandbox, and filling it with the right kind of sand to build a sandcastle that's kind of perfect for your specific shit, right? Like,
yeah.
And I like that. I like when like a filmmaker or a storyteller in general, like, and it all goes back to this whole thing of like giving Zack Snyder $300 million to make this movie did nobody favors. Why? Because it's not good. There's nothing here. There's nothing here that you haven't seen, like, on a smaller scale. It's just done in a bigger scale and in 4K. And to be quite honest, it's just, it sits there. It's inert.
Yeah.
If you've seen, if you've seen The Magnificent Seven, like, I'm not even going to say if you've seen Seven Samurai, because I'm fairly certain that most people have not seen Seven Samurai, even though it's my favorite film of all time. That's neither here nor there. But I mean, even if you saw The Magnificent Seven, or you saw like anything that references that, you've seen this movie and you've seen, probably seen a better version of it.
Yeah. I hate that. The best thing you can say about a movie is like, well, at least he employed some people, like,
yeah,
who needed that, jobs.
Which is sad, right? Like, that's the saddest thing. It's like, come on, really?
I mean, I'm happy, like, for them. I'm happy they all got to work. Hope everybody got paid. But, like, you want the end result to have, to at least be enjoyable. Like,
yes. You
know, I hate that.
Yeah, so, no, me too.
Take another turn here. One, have you seen the Marvel Coca-Cola trailer? Or it's, yes, not even a trailer, a commercial. It's
the not commercial. A trailer. Yes, I have. Yes, I have.
It might be my favorite commercial of all time.
Wow, okay, that's saying a lot. Like,
I was like that. So fucking blown away. Like, I hate those stupid Coke commercials. I hate them.
Yeah.
Like, I'm a Coke Zero drinker. Well, I used to be. They changed the flavor. I don't like it so much anymore.
Oh,
but they did. I was, right? Yeah, about 2 years ago, they tweaked it so it's, quote, better. But it feels a lot like when they had New Coke when we were kids.
Oh,
it's like,
God.
This isn't better. It's bullshit. But it's whatever.
Okay.
But I've never liked the Coke commercials. Have always seemed so bullshitty, pandering, whatever. But like,
yeah,
now they're pandering specifically to me, and I'm like, oh, this is awesome.
Logan was like, after the first commercial, he was like, I fucking feel seen, motherfuckers. Yes, they are great commercials, though. Like, I will give you that much. Like they're. I mean, I don't drink soda. Like, I know it sounds fucking weird, but, like, I got away from soda a long time ago. Now, occasionally I will, the only exception is, like, I will occasionally have soda at the movie theater, which I did this weekend, yeah. To which, like, so, like just a weird side tangent about, like, if we're talking soda and stuff, like, AMC, like, this is how fucking crass they are. They actually promote on their fucking soda machines. They promote new flavors of fucking soda on their machine. And I'm not going to be like, come on, really? But the benefit of this is that, like, they promoted a new soda. I was like, and it worked on me. I was like, oh, they have pineapple flavor now.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's check it. And I tried the, like, I tried, like, because it's a soda fountain, you can come out if you want to. So, like, when I went to go see the movie that I went to go see, I tried the multiple versions of that fucking thing, right? And, yeah, it's great. But, like, it's just weird, right? Like, that they're promoting soda flavors now. Like, we've gotten to that point. Those commercials are kind of brilliant in the way that they do them. Like, have you seen, like, okay, so, like, the first question is that, have you seen the full thing? The full, yes. Like, the full 2 minute commercial? Because yes. that's the thing that's great. Like, I love that.
There are some clearly recognizable characters,
yes.
But there are definitely characters in there that, like, are, like, the Juggernaut is heavily featured in this commercial.
Yes, like, he is.
That's crazy. Like it made me so happy. So the Marvel Coke bottles have been popping up. Like they're starting to like really get out there.
Yes.
I was blown away by the characters that they even had on them. I texted you a week ago. I was like, there is a Cable on a Coke bottle. What world are we living in? Like, I know he was featured in a big movie, but like most people are still like, oh yeah, I forgot his name was Cable. Like he is my favorite comic book character of all time. Something I found out this week that I shared with Van Lathan on the Ringerverse made me really happy. And he's on a fucking Coke bottle. I was like, this is crazy. I still cannot find the Deadpool one, but the search continues. Which actually, it's a little side tangent. I'm probably going to Walmart later today. I will dig through all the machines and look for the Deadpool Coke bottle. But I also found out last night, I'm not sure if you're aware, but Walmart has, they do this from time to time. They re-release Blu-rays and they yes. put new sleeves on them. And it's a Walmart thing, but I don't think it's specifically like it's a Walmart exclusive, but it's not something that they do. It's always a studio driven thing. So a bunch of 20th Century Fox movies are being put out through Walmart with new sleeves that feature Deadpool as the on the cover of the DVD or the Blu-ray sleeve. So it's like the Terminator, but it's Deadpool on the sleeve instead of Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Oh, really?
Yes.
That's awesome, dude. Like, oh man. The question is, did you pick it up?
So they're all about $7 to $10 a piece. So the question becomes, is it necessarily unethical to buy a bunch of them, take them home, take the DVD sleeves off, and then return them without the sleeves?
I would say no. I would say no, because they're just sleeves, right?
Right. I'm not gonna open the Blu-rays. I'm not like I just want the sleeves, it seems like there's 16 of them. Let's see. Apparently I can go on eBay and just get all 16 of them for $200. Speed, Predator, Office Space, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, Revenge of the Nerds, Edward Scissorhands, Assassin's Creed, War of the Planet of the Apes, Logan. The Logan one's interesting because it's the Logan cover like of his hand with the claws, uh-huh. and instead of her hand holding his hand, it's Deadpool's like little bitty hand.
Oh Jesus, that's hilarious. That is hilarious. I love that.
X-Men Apocalypse, X-Men First Class, The Terminator, Fight Club, My Cousin Vinny, X-Men Days of Future Past, and I can't tell what this last one is. Let's see. Oh, Castaway.
Man.
I wonder if I can save this picture and send it to you.
Okay.
I can screenshot it. I can definitely screenshot it. They're so fucking delightful. Like, I mean, I think I have to get them. Like, even if somehow I can't return the movies, like, I don't know, man. Like, so, like, the First Class one, The Apocalypse one, yeah, maybe, but like all the non X-Men ones, like the
oh shit, that's hilarious.
The Castaway,
the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly
is so good, right? Alien.
The Castaway one is great too. Like they're all fucking hilarious. Like my favorite is the Castaway one has to be my favorite because it's just it's Wilson. Like that's great. That's fucking great. Oh my god.
So
oh my god. Like some of the ones are like super awesome. Like and super inventive, right? Like the oh man, that's so funny. Like, oh man, I'm looking at other ones, like the other ones that they have, like, oh my god. And the best part is that on the side, like, they just didn't do the front. Like, I'm looking at something, like another image, like on the side, they have the Deadpool stuff too. Like, it's like on the, like, it's on the side panel. So like when you're looking at them from the side, they also have Deadpool there. Like, the Martian, they have the fucking Martian, and he's in the Martian uniform. It's fucking, or the Martian outfit. That's fucking great. yeah, like literally. Oh my god, yeah, that's fucking awesome. Like, talk about great promotions. Like, you know,
yeah.
Like that's fucking hilarious. Oh,
so
man, that is
so
hilarious.
Yeah, I might be might be spending a lot of money on Blu-rays.
testing the waters of the returns. Like, let's hope that it's a Costco return and shit.
Yeah.
like the Costco level return where they don't give a shit. They're like, oh, beep, 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 beep.
I mean, most of the time they don't.
Yeah.
But, so yeah, I might be doing that later today. Anyway, let's talk about something we both watched. Okay. So we went to the theater.
Yes.
Separately, because we're in different states. But we both this weekend got to see the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. The name is problematic.
To say the least, because you're sitting there trying to tongue-tie. You're like, the Justice Department of Wickedness or something like that? Like, it's such a fucking, like it's such a British title. Like, that it's too British. Like, it's too much, right? But, like, I told you, like when I texted you something, and I don't normally say something like this, but I was like, man, that movie was a hoot. Like, it literally just, like, it's, like, low-key British, kind of, like, with the exception of being hyper-violent, with the stabbiness, like, I kind of loved it. It was a delight. It was a delightful, like, fun little men on a mission film. Like,
I don't know if I can say I love the movie, mm-hmm. but holy shit, did I have a lot of fun with it? And it was a nice reminder. Like, I honestly, like, I'm scrolling through his. So this is the first Guy Ritchie movie I've seen in almost 15 years.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So okay. I don't know if I saw the second Sherlock Holmes movie.
Okay.
I think I did, but I don't remember. And I haven't seen anything he's done since. I've heard that Man of U.N.C.L.E. is a lot of fun, but I just didn't do it. I didn't see The Gentlemen. At some point I kind of lost, like, I was like he's just not making stuff that I want to watch. That first Sherlock Holmes movie I did not enjoy. So I knew it was Guy Ritchie, so that was the one thing I was like I kind of just don't like his movies anymore. Like, I don't ever see anything that makes me want to see his movies. But the trailer was really, really interesting. And you said you had a good time. So I was like, I'm definitely going to go see this. So I went to a late show last night. Me and two other people in the theater. It was great. I was the only person laughing. But yeah, an absolute fucking fun time at the movies, and Guy Ritchie doing what he knows how to do. I loved every... So I sat down thinking, like, this is going to be, like... I'm going to wind up thinking this movie's too long. Like, that it's... Like, because most movies like this now, I'm just like, I don't want to spend 3 hours in the fucking movie theater. Like, it's just going to be too long. But I wound up loving every fucking second of it. Like, he makes such good use of, like, the tension without drawing it out, like, too much. Like, it's never just too much. He knows, like, right when to break, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. He's a guy that does tone really well. And to me, like, that's the ultimate, like, test of a filmmaker and a storyteller is, can you tell a story in 2 hours, which he does? It's a 2-hour movie with credits. Like, you know, of course, if you're going to see it at an AMC or any other place like a Regal, there's a half hour of trailers. But I mean, you can't blame him for that. But telling a story efficiently, but also telling it with style, but also being able to get that tone right, like that, be able to push and pull an audience to give them the experience that you kind of need them to have. And yeah, man, like, talk about like being able to like do the right, like be able to like balance the film in such a way where it doesn't feel like it's a slog, because we've seen this kind of Nazi men on a mission film.
I mean, it's not a one-to-one comparison with Tarantino, but like it does feel it in the way that Guy Ritchie has always kind of been like the British Tarantino. This does kind of feel like the British Inglourious Bastards.
It really does. So much so, playing with like certain people, like, okay, so like it's based on a true story. Like, and I say, we say that in quotes, right?
Like, so the mission happened, like, maybe not exactly like to the level, like the extreme, like it, yeah, it's not word for word, you know?
No, it's really not. But like what he does with this movie, like what he does with the story and the man on a mission film is pure Guy Ritchie. Like it really is pure Guy Ritchie. Like the way that it's told in the nonlinear storyline, like, and he does nonlinear story different than Quentin does, right? Like he each of them does that kind of thing, and you are right. Like he is like the British Tarantino, right? Like, except for he produces more, he like has output more, and like, you know. But I will say this about this particular movie, which is that like the ensemble is like, it's designed for entertainment, and I didn't realize how kind of like between the, like, okay, so like between the couple, like the group that they get together, I didn't realize how entertaining each of them was, but together they're like this weird kind of perfect ensemble cast led by Henry Cavill, right? Like,
did you know that Alex Pettifer could actually act
and
be good in something? Like,
I did not, like, that was the biggest surprise, right? Like, when you, like, it took me a while to recognize that it was
until
him.
I didn't know it was him until the credits rolled. I was like,
oh, wow.
I fucking know that guy. And, like, I was like, holy shit, that was Alex Pettifer? Like, who was supposed to be, like, the next big It boy? Like,
yep. He was supposed to be a Hemsworth.
I am number 4 or whatever.
Yep. I Am Number 7 or something like that. Yeah, whatever that called. Movie was.
And, like, that movie was not great. I mean, I could probably go back and look at it now and be like, oh, it's not him. It's just that. But, yeah, he was going to be, like, all, like, you know, Sam Worthington was kind of in the same boat where it's like, oh, they're going to be, and also that Australian guy that was in Pacific Rim, like positioned as like, oh, if they're going to be the next big thing. And then like Worthington, like rightfully hitched his star to James Cameron. So like, he didn't get launched into the stratosphere the way a lot of people, probably his management, hoped, but he's at least saddled to the biggest franchise of all time. Like, yes, that isn't Star Wars or Marvel.
And he's going to be making like 10 more of these fucking movies. So he doesn't have to, him and Zoe Saldana do not have to worry about Jack or shit for the next decade.
But yeah, like Alex Pettifer, like, it's a name I have not heard in a long fucking time, to quote Star Wars, to paraphrase Star Wars. I was like, holy shit, that was Alex Pettifer. Like, you would think that Henry Cavill and Alan Richardson were like they are the selling points. Like, they might put the butts in the seats, and they're both delightful. But yes, everybody else in the movie is fucking fantastic.
they really are. Like the one, okay, so the person that surprised me the most, where I was like, man, did they Megan Fox her, is Aliza Gonzalez. Like, I was not expecting this like piece of badassery from her that we got. And like, that's probably Guy Ritchie writing, like, you know, Guy Ritchie writing the part of Marjorie Stewart, who was a real life figure. Like, she, like, Marjorie Stewart is a real life person who was an actress that worked with British SAS intelligence I knew about her, and I knew about her because of films that she's been in, where I listened to a commentary track and they were like, oh, well, the most interesting part about this movie is Marjorie Stewart, and it has nothing to do with her acting. Like, her and I'm gonna ruin his name, but Babs Olasunmukun as Mr. Heron, like, their storyline is like, fucking awesome.
We're in the movie, so, you know, we might spoil it, and I'm definitely gonna spoil something here. When it looked like he was gonna die, I was fucking upset, man. I was like,
oh yeah,
fuck. Like, he got caught. Like, this is the end of it. And then he shoots the one guy with the you know, the trick gun. And then it jams. And I was like, then I was like, oh, fuck yeah, they pulled the Indiana Jones. And the gun jams and doesn't shoot the last guy. And I was like, no. Like, he's going to die here. And then, you know, he makes it out. But, like, I was really upset.
No, I was too. It's a movie that treads on tension, but the thing is that, and spoilers for it, like everything ends exactly like you want it to, right? Like, you don't want anybody dead, but there's this component of like real tension that Ritchie is able to draw out. And I will say this much. I love Ritchie for the threat of sexual violence towards Aliza Gonzalez, which I'm fairly certain that fucking Quentin would have dove into very relishly, but he so doesn't. Like, Ritchie doesn't, like, it's the threat, and the threat is enough. To which, like, I love the fact that Till Schweiger, who's like in Inglourious Basterds, as Hugo Stiglitz, the German who hates Nazis and kills them, and he's playing the most repugnant Nazi, like, in the last couple of years. And that's saying a lot, because there's been a lot of Nazis recently, but, like, it's just kind of, it's kind of great that, like, the way that he builds it up, and you think that it's going to happen, but it never happens. And, like, you know, like, the grossness of that kind of bullshit that so many male filmmakers do. But just the threat of it is enough, right? Like, you see a certain thing of what he is capable of. And then throughout the whole film, it's like this threat of violence. And then when she gets the upper hand on him, like you still like the cleverness of that upper handness. And when she like ends him, it's like so great because it's such a way to go out. Right. Like,
yeah.
It's kind of like the way that he's playful, like Richie is playful. Like we haven't even gotten to the best part of this thing, which is that, like, okay, so spoilers, guys. If you don't want to know the big reveal of this, skip ahead. But, like, the fact that they have Ian Fleming,
yeah,
and, like, it literally serves as, like, if this is my great hope.
It's a fucking James Bond origin Bond story. Movie.
Exactly. if Henry Cavill fucking gets Bond, like, everybody is thinking that he might get, this serves as Guy Ritchie putting a middle finger to like the Fleming, like the Bond filmmakers, and go, guess what, bitches? You can't make Henry Cavill, the Henry Cavill origin story, or like the Henry Cavill James Bond origin story, because I fucking did it. Or it's a calling card and saying, I want to direct Bond. Like it feels like a dare, a fuck you, and a calling card all at the same time, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's so hilarious, a Bond origin story that we did not know that we needed. And my favorite part is that they actually have, so Winston Churchill is played by Rory Kinnear, who's in the James Bond movies,
yeah,
in the Daniel Craig James Bond movies, as, like, this, I don't know, like, his name is Tanner, right? And he's kind of, like, M's right-hand man. So, like, and he's in all, like, I think he's not in Casino Royale, but he's in everything after that. Quantum of Solace, Skyfall, Spectre, and then, what's that, No Time to Die. But, like, it's that cleverness. It's like, when are we gonna, like, at this point between The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and this movie, when are we gonna give Guy Ritchie a shot at directing a Bond film? I mean, why not?
I'm going to throw this out there. Like, nobody's going to listen to me. And I get, uh-huh, like Henry Cavill. And then, well, supposedly what's his name is like the front runner now for Bond. What is his name? I'm drawing a blank.
Movies he's been in.
I'm Googling it right now. Bond front runner. No, not that guy. Aaron Taylor Johnson.
I've heard. Okay, so that's been denied.
Okay, so he's out.
So, but anywho, no. But Aaron Taylor Johnson, we'll go with him. Yeah. Oh my God, no, so, not him.
Yeah, I agree, and like, mm-hmm, I get like the appeal of Henry Cavill, but I'm just putting it out there because. I just realized, like I said, that this kid can act. Give it to Alex Pettifer, man.
Like, oh, man. That would be fucking wild. But also, after this movie, I can totally see it. And
I understand that Henry Cavill's character is, like, there's this, like, believed to be the basis for Fleming's Bond. But mm-hmm, when they show up to rescue... I can't remember his name in the movie, but Alex Pettifer's character.
Yeah.
And he's sitting there like chained to that thing with the thing on the his nipples.
Yes.
Like that's the most Bond thing in the fucking movie. And that scene is so fun. Like he's just watching like tear apart these guys.
Yes.
While this car battery is clamped to his nipples and he's bleeding everywhere, I'm like, oh my God, this is great.
Like, which, like, man, I didn't even think about that because he's so British. Like, he is very, very British, like Alex Pettifer. And, like, you know, he's in the age range that you want, like mid-30s, right? Like, that's perfect. Like that would be a great That would be an inspired casting choice and a bold one too, right? Because like Bonds have always been semi-well-known after very well-known after Connery, right? Like Roger Moore was very well-known. Lazenby was kind of a wild card. It would be hilarious if Alex Pettifer became the George Lazenby of the Bond world. Like he just did one and everybody was so kind of non-committal about it that they were let's go with somebody else. But that's actually an inspired piece of casting, Logan. That's really great.
Cavill's a lot of fun.
His
stuff in this movie, I don't even know how to describe it. It's kind of sick, the joy he has, but that's the character he's playing, you know? Like when he murders the Nazis and then fucking steals the coat and the hat and then proceeds to walk around like a fucking SS officer.
Which it comes back multiple times in the movie with him wearing it so that he can just sit around and walking. Like the scene between him and Hero Finis Tiffin, who plays Henry Hayes, the Irish guy.
Another guy that's fucking great. So, yes. But that's in his blood. He's the nephew of the Fiennes brothers.
The brothers,
Ralph and
Made me forget Joseph, yeah.
Yeah, and then he played young Tom Riddle.
Yes, he did. Is thus proving to live up to the reputation of a Fiennes, the Fiennes family, right? Like it's really he's really good. He's really, really good. Like in this movie, I really did like him. We gotta talk about Alan Ritchson as Anders Lassen, the Swedish psychopath that's just murder, death, killing Nazis an arrow and a knife.
He is doing the kind of Hugo Stiglitz sort of thing.
Yeah,
but honestly, it sucks because I really, really do love that movie. But I enjoyed him doing that more than it was Schreier, so much fun. When they're on that hillside, when they're going to break out Alex Pettifer's character, and those Nazis walk up on them and they turn around and just the guys fall to the ground and they're like, what happened? It looks like they've been shot. By what? There's arrows. It just went straight through them. And then Alan Ritchson comes. He's got that fist full of fucking arrows with the bow. Yep. It's what the hell, man? They're like, oh, okay. I guess you can do that. We don't need a sniper. We have this dude with his bow and arrow.
I mean, but then again, when you think about it, you don't need a sniper if the dude is built like Alan Ritchson, right? The best part about that is, he's got that, he's got his bow and arrow and he's shooting at people. And, you literally believe that a dude like Alan Ritchson, because he's so fucking massively hulking, can take out a dude at 300 yards with a bow and arrow. It's very, very, it's a smart bit of casting, though I think that it was a multi-layered smart bit of casting, because him and Cavill working together, it's weird because, there's all this chemistry between, everybody in the movie, which I love. I love when you're able to get these guys to actually feel like...
It reminds me of those, 70s... like Dirty Dozen type of
yes, very much so.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, So Tarantino's movie does have some of that as well. Like, there is character chemistry there. But that movie works with... That movie is set pieces, right?
Yes.
Like, different set pieces, different sets of actors, like, different bits of chemistry. This is all, really relying on two sets of people. You know, like them together, and then the other two that we mentioned before.
Aliza Gonzalez and the guy who plays Mr. Heron. And I'm sorry that I'm not pronouncing his name, but I don't want to butcher his name. But they're on their way to West Africa, the West African port that Fernando Po. That's not his name, but the port is called Fernando Po.
Which, did you get, holy shit, is this, I want to read this fucking book now and read more into the story, because, I want to know what's added to the movie and what's actual real life, because, not for nothing, but... Is Rick from Casablanca based on this? If this guy's a real life character, is this fucking Rick from Casablanca?
that was my thought on it. I was very, very, very interested in this book. Like, I wrote down the name of it and I was like, okay, well, I'm gonna go ahead and get this eventually, because this is pretty fucking amazing, if this is true, right? And then, on a side note, the book that it's based on is out of print. It's gonna cost you $200 to get it. At least that's what, if it's the, when I looked it up, I was like, oh, well, that's great. Maybe they'll bring it. They didn't think about bringing it up, or reprinting it. But it's from 10 years ago. But anywho, yes, I totally want to fucking read this book, because you said, this Mr. Heron, he seems like the
it's a very Casablanca-esque kind of thing he has going on. You know,
absolutely.
But where he's working with the Nazis, but against the Nazis, and he's kind of overseeing a lot of this small island and or port. I guess it's not really an island. Just overseeing this port, and not only does he have to deal with the German Nazis, he also has to deal with the Italian people and the Spanish people. And he's tiptoeing all these lines while secretly working with the British, to try to sabotage them. And so did this movie go, oh, we'll just do the Casablanca thing? Or was fucking Rick from Casablanca actually based on a real life guy? Because that's fucking mind blowing to me.
No, it really is. And it's a great, it's every part of this movie is super interesting, but the whole Fernando Po part of it was the most interesting to me, because it's something that you rarely, rarely see in war films now, which is the negotiation of the minutiae of places that were occupied, right? Yeah. Or not occupied, Casablanca, or the spycraft work of it all,
just the idea of the supply chain.
Exactly.
It's the kind of thing that George Lucas was trying to do with the prequels. This is part of warfare. The supply chain is a huge deal. It is a make or break in war. If you cannot get your people fed or get them weapons, or you fall apart. And but the thing is, it's not really an interesting thing to discuss. And this movie manages to make it at least, if not interesting, at least understandable and palatable. Where you're like, oh, I understand what they're doing, why they're doing it, you know, why it needs to be done, and not dwelling on, like, you know, a lot of back. Like, there's not a huge scene of them in Parliament debating this shit for 10 minutes. It's like, what the fuck are we talking about? You know, there is some, like, some stuff, like, said in rooms, you know, to kind of give you, like, hey, there's some political machinations at work here. I thought it was, like, really interesting to show, like, I mean, Churchill's such a polarizing figure, and this movie, I think, does a good job of walking the fine line of, like, there's a very interesting scene where it shows him sitting there in the middle of the night as the Nazis fucking bomb his country, knowing that literally 2 days earlier, he could have accepted this quote peace deal and saved people's lives. And he refused to do it.
Refuses to do it. Yep.
And like, that's, you know, that's fucking, that's tough, man.
Yeah.
Like, and, you know, it's something, I guess, as Americans, we don't get to see. We just don't get it put in our faces, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We were the, you know, the cavalry who, and this movie does present it that way. Like, Churchill basically is like, we're going to fucking lose unless we can figure out how to get the Americans involved. They're not going to get involved if there's no chance of winning this. Like, he's got to find a way to show them something can be done, you know? I don't know. As fun and delightful as the movie is, it's really informative on, like what actually was happening, you know? It's more openly talked about now, but, like, there's a lot of fucking Nazi sympathizers in America. when that was going down.
When that was going on, like, okay, so, like there's a great David Simon who wrote The Wire. Like, there's a great HBO series that he did that's based off of a historical account, the plot to Take Over America, which is all about Nazi sympathizers trying to embed themselves in politics. Very kind of, I'm not even gonna make an analogy, but at the time. It was a big thing. It was a big thing in America, that something that we've bleached over, and which I don't think that we ever should have. Like, you know, it's like with what happens in Germany, like, you know what happened in Germany, right? Like, they did a whole reckoning with it, and they talk about it very openly so that it never happens again. They made it illegal, and they made it in such a way, like, this is my favorite part about Germany, what Germany did, which was that they made it illegal for any Nazi paraphernalia, any Nazi dictums, any kind of ideology that's anywhere close to fascism to be anywhere. And it's punishable by time in prison. Like, literally, they made it so that you cannot do anything Nazi, like, affiliated in Germany. And if you do, guess what? The cops are going to come after you. Their feds are going to come after you, and you're going to prison. Like, not even for a little bit of time. It's not even like you get, like, it's a punishable by X to X. Like, it's something, like, it's really harsh. It's something like 5 to 7 years for something like that. Like, you know, but again, going back to the whole thing of, like the concepts here are so, like, they're so right on, they're so multi-layered, but it's, like, so much so that, like you said, like what Lucas was trying to do with the prequels that just didn't happen, that, of course, Filoni, like this goes back to, like, it all roads lead back to Filoni, who was able to, like, do what he was trying to do with the series. Like I feel like if Filoni had seen this movie like 20 years ago when he was making Clone Wars, he would have reprocessed it.
Kind of the Bad Batch, right?
Exactly. Like, no, that's exactly what it is, right? Like, but not like post-war. It's like the Bad Batch in the middle of the war, right? Like, if we got a prequel series about the Bad Batch, about what they did in the war, like, this would be it. Like, it's kind of brilliant. Again, all roads lead back to Star Wars for us. But that's not a bad thing.
I appreciate that Ritchie does, like, absolutely present it from the British point of view, but is also not like the way it's been typically done. Maybe not lately, but with America, like, we present it from our point of view, and we're always like, we were talking about. You know, you don't hear a lot about American Nazi sympathizers until, you know, more recent years, the last few decades. Like, when we were kids, we didn't even know that that was a thing. Like, we, you know, it was more or less presented like, oh, we didn't really know what was going on over there, when that's just not fucking true. You know, it was just, we weren't going to get involved in a war where it's like, oh, like the U-boats, like, we can't get past them, you know, like we can't get past them. So it's just be sending people over there to die because we got to cross the fucking ocean. And once they could get past the U-boats, because the British cut off their supply chain. So it becomes a winnable thing. Like, oh, now we can storm the beaches of Normandy. There's no U-boats. I'll say all that to say, I like that Guy Ritchie, it also doesn't like hold back from showing both sides of like where Britain was. Like, you have Churchill with these like tough decisions, and but like you also have like the British, like, I don't know how to put it, because I don't want to sound shitty, but this idea of like, no, we can't, like, Black Ops missions didn't exist. Like, this kind of shit didn't happen because it was seen as, like, uncouth or something, you know?
Exactly. No, you're absolutely right. And, like, I like that. I like that. Like, it's weird because it's, like, every aspect of warfare, no matter how weird or contrite that somebody thinks it is really discussed here and perfectly integrated into the story. Like, all the stuff that you're talking about right now is literally in the movie, but it takes up about 3 minutes of screen time, which is wild, right? But we're sitting here having a full...
Well, like...
Executed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, where somebody else would have taken 5 hours to George do this. Yeah, exactly. He, like, literally, Ritchie is able to do it with just a few key scenes, but also some
without
visuals.
Any boring ass shit. Like, there's no like long, boring ass like exposition thing. Like, it's the most it gets is like explaining what the U-boat problem is and how they can solve it by cutting off that supply chain. And it takes a minute and a half, like maybe 3 minutes, like you said. Like, it takes almost no time. Like, hey, our ships are getting destroyed by these U-boats. The U-boats are getting supplies from this port that is not German controlled. So, and they vary, but they're like, Hitler's cheating. He's cheating in war because he's not in his occupied territory. Like, that's such a British, like, way of thinking about it. I hate to, but it's also when you go back to the Revolutionary War, like, that was how they fought wars, and they came to America to like fight a, like there was a, we're gonna go to war, like, and we didn't fight that way. Like, it wasn't like marching on a battlefield to a drum beat and like very, you know, regimented. And it was like, no, we're in the trees, motherfuckers. Like, we're jumping down with hatchets, hitting you. Like, and it, like, it's like so antithetical to like what the British Empire like wanted to, you know, it's such an interesting thesis. Like, it's a fascinating movie that's extremely fun, informative, and like thought provoking in a way you wouldn't think it would be.
No, absolutely. Like, it's this, like, man, like, it's the kind of film that we do not get anymore. The unexpected delight of a film that has multiple layers but doesn't call attention to it. It's not like, I love Guy Ritchie because this man does not care about the bullshit of awards and trying to make something highfalutin, like, more than, like, he wants to make movies, right? He doesn't want to make films. But in a weird way, he's like, I know this is going to sound weird, but in a weird way, he feels like the way that Tony Scott approached filmmaking, which is like, I can almost see him saying, nah, mate, we're not making a film. We're making a movie, because that's what it is. It's a, like, and there's a distinct comparison between what a film is with a capital F and what a movie is. And he makes a movie that ends up being a film. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like, it's what it is. Like, it's all these things. Like, it's entertaining, it's informative, it speaks to so much that we've not discussed in war, but it's done in a package that is so entertaining at the 2 hour mark, right? Like, it's literally everything. Like, it's three times the story at half the price. It's 10 times the story of Rebel Moon at a tenth of the cost and half the length, or two-thirds the length. I mean, yeah. It's like, how can you resist something like that? Like, at least to me, it's not an option of like, oh, well, and maybe.
Like, best of all, maybe. Like, I get, like, the woke stuff. I get the cancel culture. I get, like, but for the most part, people who aren't absolute pieces of shit, we can all agree on one thing. Whatever the fuck you're doing to a Nazi, it's fine. It's fine.
Exactly. And, like,
Alan, and you can kind of, like, just revel in it. Like, just, you know, there's a moment at the end of the film when they're stealing the boat, which I love that the plan just boils down to, oh, we'll just steal the fucking boat. And they can't drive it. They can't pilot it. They just have to tow it out to open water. But there's a moment towards the end of the film where they have murdered hundreds of Nazi soldiers, and like, they're on this boat, they think they've killed everybody, and Henry Cavill comes around a corner and there's this kid in a Nazi sailor's uniform,
yeah, like,
cowering on the deck, and he's got his gun on him, and I honestly thought he was gonna shoot him. Then I was like, oh, he's going to let him go. That's kind of sweet, I guess. And then I thought he was going to shoot him again. And I don't think I get that I'm happy he lets him jump in the water. And, like, it's a very kind of sweet, like, human moment. But also, if he'd have just shot him in the back, I don't think I would have cared either. Like, it's a very strange thing.
It is, but I felt the same way. Like, I was like, shoot this motherfucker. Show kids what happens when you try to fuck around. You're going to find out. And how much do you want to bet in the book, if there's some kind of scene like that, fucking James Bond, a.k.a. Henry Cavill as James Bond, fucking took care of it. Like, literally took care of it. Like, that's the thing that I think about. I'm like, yeah, he probably would have fucking taken care of him. Because why do you want a baby Nazi to grow up to be a full-on Nazi, right? Because he ain't gonna learn shit. But I do like the moment of humanity. But like you said, it could have gone either way.
Yeah, and I was okay either way. I can really appreciate that about, like, oh, we can still make movies about, like, yeah, fuck the Nazis. Like, just kill them all. I want to ask you one thing. Not, it's about the movie, but not what's on screen.
Okay.
What did you think about the score?
Oh my God, dude. Thank you for mentioning it. The Italian spaghetti Western, like, flavored.
Okay. So soundtrack? It wasn't just me. It's like, what if Morricone did jazz?
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm not at all familiar. The guy that the composer is Christopher Benstead. He's been working almost exclusively with Guy Ritchie since The Gentlemen back in 2019. That was the first movie he scored. He's been in the music department of tons of movies, but that was his first, like, score. But I haven't seen any of those Guy Ritchie movies, so I'm, like, completely unfamiliar with this dude. And, like, sometimes I thought it was a little overwhelming, but, like, that's also jazz to me. Like, I don't love jazz music, but there's some jazz music that I love. Like, sometimes I'm like, this is just too fucking much. It's loud and overpowering, and like the rhythm, like, it's a rhythm, but it's not like one you're used to. Like, everything feels a little off, but like, also it's still kind of compelling and pulling you in. And like, I really did enjoy the score, even though, like I said, sometimes I was like, it's a little too much, but it's kind of supposed to be. So, like, I was just curious if it was me. I felt the same way. I was like, this feels like spaghetti Western, but jazz.
Yeah. No, it's really great. Like, I instantly wanted to, like, hear it on Spotify when I got back home, because it's like, I love spaghetti Western scores. I love Morricone. And it's unfortunately not there yet, which I'm fairly certain, give it a couple of weeks. I'm going to haunt my usual vinyl websites, because I kind of want this score on vinyl. I mean, I'm a score, like, we've talked about this before. We're long on the record of being score, like, vinyl guys, and especially about scores. So I will keep you posted, but it's a great, like, it is a great kind of kick-ass score that's unexpected. It's very unexpected.
I definitely didn't expect the, like, jazzness of it all. Because that's such it is such an American thing. Like, I know it's worldwide. Even by that point, it's worldwide. But I expected it to be more militaristic. Does that make sense?
Yes, a, like, little
grassy
bit more,
and, you know,
yeah, kind of like I was expecting the Great Escape kind of soundtrack.
Yes,
right.
Yes, yes, which, like, has, like, a fun little, like, jaunt to it, but also feels like staunch and regimented too.
Yes, and it has a sense of, like, this does not have a sense of forebodingness.
No.
in any way, shape, or form, but... Which
actually makes it more tense, I think.
Yes, it does. Like, that's what I was going to say, is that there's nothing to cue you that it's going to go bad, and it creates that tension that's kind of like, oh, what's going to fucking happen here?
Yeah, because the music isn't telling you what's about to happen, so for some fucking reason, it makes it worse, because, like, every time they go into, like... battle mode or whatever you want to call it, like, we know they're about to face off against somebody, and this like jazz shit starts, like, the music isn't telling me how I'm supposed to feel, and it's making me so fucking anxious.
Oh, 150%, 150%. But I also think that Richie did that on purpose. His needle drops are as fucking perfect as Quentin's needle drops, so it makes sense to me that his, like, he had very much a purpose for his score, right? Like, there was a reason why he chose, like, the spaghetti western flavored score. You know, it's all in service to, like, a really great entertaining film, right? Like, that's what I loved about it, is that it was entertaining before it anything. Like, and then the secondary stuff was all piled on. And like I said, like, it wasn't, it's one of those movies that you go in and you go, oh, it's Guy Ritchie, I'm going to, like, you know, I expect things, and you get them, but it's delivered at a level that you're not expecting, like, how good and layered it is. And
it makes me want to go back and watch the stuff I've missed. Like, I think you talked about his movie from last year, the Jason Statham movie, right?
Yes, which is basically his low budget version of Dead Reckoning.
Yeah.
But with Aubrey Plaza. And I feel like that's the thing that's going to, like, that's going to key you into it. Cause I know that you're like, think that you're like me, where you're a big Aubrey Plaza fan.
I am. I haven't watched enough of her stuff in recent years, but I am a fan of hers. Absolutely.
Yeah. And it's just kind of like, it's like I said, it's like Jason Statham and Guy Ritchie decided, oh, we want to make a movie. We want to make it like a spy movie. Let's make it about AI. And literally, they didn't realize that they were making, like, it's almost like maybe they read the script of Dead Reckoning, and then they were like, you know what? Let's fucking steal this and bring this out before he brings out his movie, and we'll kind of... We'll get a little bit of the sales underneath us. And of course it didn't prove to be, because it like, you know, nobody went to go see it, which I always feel like it was a big shame, because the way that they handle things and the way that it works is so much fun, but it's in the Guy Ritchie British sort of way. So it's done very kind of breezy. It's very similar to this film. Like, it very much so is, like, it feels like, if he does another one of these Men on a Mission film and, like, makes a sci-fi version of it, then we've gotten everything, right? We got World War II, we got modern, and then we got the future. Like, and I don't, like, that was the thing I was thinking about, was I was like, you know, what kind of movie do I want to see Guy Ritchie tackle next? Because he's able to, like, be elastic.
I know this is based on true stories.
Uh-huh.
And we get the little tag at the end. Oh, and we talked about everybody. We didn't talk about Henry Golding, who is a fucking, just everything in this movie is delightful, which is weird because it's so violent. But Henry Golding is so fucking fun. Like, the description that you get of him before you meet him is like, he gets upset when he's not destroying things. And then meeting this guy, it's such an apt description. Because it's just, all he wants to do is just blow shit up. Like, point me in the direction, I'm going to go blow it up.
Yes.
But I know that, like, they didn't stay together and this wasn't. But, like, in a very, like, oh, let's make three more Dirty Dozen movies kind of way. Like, I just want to see them do more of this. Like, give me some fake World War II shit with this group of people. Like, send them on another mission. Like, I don't know, man. Give me something like with these guys. Cause fuck, it's good. And also, Like, thank you for using Cary Elwes in a way like that he deserves. Like, he might be in the last like 20 years the most underutilized fucking talent. Like, I love that guy.
You're gonna love Operation Fortune then, Bruce Degar, because he literally plays the same version of, he plays the same character in this, just basically in the future. Like, you know, like it was like if he turns out to be the great great grandfather of the guy in Operation Fortune, that makes complete sense because he does the same thing. Like this is how you use Cary Elwes, not like in Rebel Moon where you keep him like fucking, oh my god, like I feel so bad. I felt so bad for him when I saw him in, I mean, at least he's unrecognizable because he's wearing like this weird long jaunty beard that looks like he's something out of ZZ Top. And doesn't look like Cary Elwes.
In Rebel Moon.
Yeah. Both parts of it. But at least here, it's like it's perfect because he's so fucking
And he's M. He's M.
Yeah. He's literally called M. He's like M. And it's like, it's almost like Guy Ritchie's like, okay, bitches, just give me Bond. Just let a Brit, like, let a true working class Brit take this on. I have my own M. I have my own Bond. Let's just do this. I mean, literally, like, let's just do this. It's kind of great. And yeah, we did not talk about Golding or Cary Elwes, and both are fantastic in this movie. Yeah. So I'm fairly certain, I'm going to make a statement about Henry Golden. Henry Golden should never not play a British man anymore because his Americanized or mid-Atlantic accent hobbles him. Like, he feels so, like, now that I've seen him where he's just playing, like, his literal accent, there's a looseness to him that it looks like he's not thinking about how to speak American. It's the same way with Cavill, right? Like, Cavill is such that I feel like when he's using an American accent, it feels forced.
Yeah, it works in Mission Impossible, right?
Yeah, it does. But Mission Impossible is the only movie, like, I will make it a point to say that his Superman, because he's English, doesn't make sense to me. Like, yeah. That's the thing. Like, I can tell he's British because of how he's enunciating things,
he's
right?
And so I know fucking charming. Like, it's. I mean, everybody is, and I know I've kept saying it, but like, it's impossible to like really express how charming he is. Like, you know. It's weird that Alan Ritchson is the comedy foil in this movie,
mm-hmm.
but he's the only one doing something broad. Like, everybody yes. else is playing in their specific lane. And Ritchson is like putting on this, like, it might be kind of accurate, but it sounds fucking ridiculous because we've all heard the guy actually speak, you know,
yes.
like that, like it's not using like a deep voice. It's more of a higher pitch.
And it's very Dieter. Like, yes, do you remember like yeah. that Mike Myers character? Oh,
yeah.
Like yeah. it's very much that, it's not meant to be serious. It's like, he literally is the like, it's weird to say this, but he is the comic relief.
He is.
Like, he's the violent, violent comic relief, but he's still the relief. And the best part is, I don't think that he was joking around. Like, I don't think that they were joking around with the whole LGBTQ comments. I think it was meant to be like kind of like an undercover thing, but he really was gay.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. like, it, like that whole moment between him and Golding. Though I think that Golding was joking, like the characters in you'd and of themselves.
You'd have to catch me first.
Yes, exactly. It was just, but it's like, that's the kind of level of deep rooted writing there is here and performing, right? Like,
yeah.
there's so much here that's so unexpectedly fun, but also smart. Like, it's one thing to be fun and dumb, but it's a completely different thing to be fun and smart or witty the way that British can be witty, right? Yeah. Like, there's a sense of wit about this whole entire movie that feels British, that feels like, and it's light on its feet. And like I said, like, it's making zero money, and that's a sad bit.
Yeah, it sucks, man, because it's so good. Like, I'm not gonna see half the amount of movies you're gonna see this year, but I will be shocked. Outside of, like, Deadpool, which at this point, my hopes might be up a little too high for Deadpool, but I can't help it. Outside of Deadpool, I don't know if I'm going to see something this year that will have been as much fun as this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I might see something that's more, way more affecting than this movie. Like, but it's just, you know... It's just fun. Like, you know, it's really a fucking shame that, like, I watched this and I was just like, yes, fucking Guy Ritchie, man. Like, yes, this is the shit he can do. Like, and I know I've missed out on a lot of his shit from recent years that's probably in the same vein and still really fun. But because Guy Ritchie did a bunch of shit where I was just like, what are you doing, man? Like, what the fuck is this Madonna movie? Like, what is this? Like, I know it's your wife, but, like, Jesus, man. And, like, the Sherlock Holmes movies, like, probably would have been easier to accept if there wasn't a fucking show on television at the same time called Sherlock with British people in it. Where I'm just like, oh, this is good. This is how you do this. Robert Downey Jr. is not good in those movies. Like, it's terrible. So, yeah, it's.
I might be on
a Guy Ritchie kick for the next few weeks.
But I think that you're going to be genuinely surprised. There's some really great fun things. There's some really great, like, serious stuff. Like his movie Man of Wrath. That's a fucking great little Jason Statham low end. It feels like a Don Siegel's Clint Eastwood movie, but it's a lot of fun because it's like it's what the beekeeper wants to be but could never be. Like, there's a lot of stuff here Guy Ritchie has done in the last 15 years since Sherlock Holmes that I feel like you're gonna enjoy and you're gonna find a lot of delight in. Like,
I'm not gonna watch Aladdin. So even though Ryan said it was good, Ryan was like, it was a lot of fun. I was like, I'm fucking out on all of those movies. Like, I'm like tepid on live action Lilo and Stitch and live action How to Train Your Dragon. Like, I'm like going in with zero like hope that they're going to be excellent, because most of the time these animated to live action things just don't work. But like, for the most part, I'm just completely out on any of that shit. Like, I tried it with The Lion King and I was like,
yeah
no.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The rest of them, they're a lot of fun.
I might start with The Gentlemen, because, like, that cast is just so fucking...
It's really good. Like, start in that order. Like, go Gentlemen, Wrath of Man, Operation Fortune.
Henry Golding's in The Gentlemen.
Yes, playing a real piece of shit. Like a real piece of shit. It's good. It feels if Lock, Stock is an angry teenager, Snatch is a drug-taking 20-year-old, The Gentleman is like the 30 to 40-year-old scotch drinker of like the crime trilogy. So, like, it's very much so in that vein. I think you're going to have a lot of fun with it, especially because he gets like a truly great all-time Matthew McConaughey performance out of Matthew McConaughey. So yeah, I'm actually looking forward to hearing what you have to say about that one.
Yeah, I know that there's a series on Netflix now too. Yes. So, yeah.
Yes, there is. That he directed three, I think, of the episodes, the first two and the last one.
I've heard good things.
I have too. I have too. I've just not made time for it, unfortunately.
Yeah. So yeah, we both really love this movie. It sucks it's not making more money. I walked out, I was like, fuck, I hope this movie makes $100 million. Probably not even gonna make its budget. But
yeah.
I mean, that's kind of been par for the course for Guy Ritchie. I hate that. But I mean, he doesn't have the pull. Like, he has the pull, like, he can get the cast, and he can, but he just doesn't, box office-wise, doesn't have the pull. I think when this movie hits Netflix, it's gonna, like, fucking...
It's gonna blow up.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's gonna blow up.
Wind up being the number one movie on Netflix, so...
Yeah, and we'll get all those terrible articles. See the movie that everybody's raving about that was a box office failure. It's like, okay, thanks, guys. Though, the best possible thing that could happen is like The Gentlemen, it gets turned into a Netflix series.
I mean, you probably can't bring back Henry Cavill.
No.
Because he's just too big of a star. But, like, nobody else is, like, that huge of a star. So, I could do it without Henry Cavill.
Like, could you imagine, like, Alex Pettifer and Alan Ritchson just leading the cast? Like, that's a, so, like...
Yeah, Ritchson might be tied up with other shit, too. But I'm telling you, man, like...
Yeah.
I hope that the right person sees this and is like, Alex Pettifer is a lot better than anybody's giving him credit for. We need to get him in something. Maybe not Bond, but something.
No, absolutely. Well, or he becomes a part of like Richie's like circle of actors. Oh yeah, absolutely.
Charlie Hunnam was the guy I was thinking about earlier, who has done a few Richie movies. He was in the King Arthur movie that Richie did that I didn't see either.
It's fun. Like, actually, you know, you may want to, like, you know how we were talking about Conan movies? Like, that take that kind of thing? It's literally a sword and sorcerer fantasy film that's supposed to start something, but it doesn't start anything. But it's weirdly attitude-y in a way that I feel like it's not terrible. It's like Aladdin, where it's like, I feel like, okay, and this is my ultimate thesis about Guy Ritchie. Guy Ritchie should not be, like, I know why he's doing it. Like, Aladdin gave him the ability to make 10 more films because of his box office, like, the box office success of that. And I know he's making, like, he's coming back for Aladdin 2, so we're going to have more Aladdin, like, you know, more Aladdin. Fucking Jafar. Like, I hope they remake, what's the one? Jafar's Revenge?
The Return of Jafar.
Yes, I hope they make that. I hope he goes, we're gonna make this. But, like, Richie should only have, like, a smaller, like, have a lower echelon budget, but allowed to do most of what he wants, right? Like, get an ensemble cast. Like, that's where he works best. Like, these $50 million action movies or crime films that have a great cast and a genius script. Like, that's him. Like, let him do that. Like, let him do what Quentin does, but at a lesser budget, and you're going to get gold every time. Literally every time. Like, I love Richie. I've always loved Richie. I even through the bad stuff, I've been there for him. Because, I mean, he was, like, one of those guys, like, Lock, Stock was a movie that came around when I was like 18, and it hits right, just like fucking Quentin. When, like, I was 14 when Reservoir Dogs came out. It hits like a ton of bricks, right? I feel like the way, like, I was trying to make a comp to it for people so that they can understand, because I was talking to a friend about it, and he's a lot younger than me. He's like half our age, right? He's like in his mid 20s. And I was like, and he's like, man, what the fuck is this whole Richie stuff? Like, I don't get it. He's like, you love him. And I'm like, and the only comp I could give him was, I was like, he's like the Safdies when you saw the Safdies. Like, it hit hard, right? Yeah. And he goes, oh, I'm yeah.
Like, oh, shit. Like, yeah. What the fuck is going on here?
I'm like, you haven't had the time where, like, at the time.
Well, you live in a post Richie world. Like, it's like going back to watch Tarantino and just being like, yeah, what's the big deal? It's like, it was a big deal because nobody was doing that. Like, now people are doing it. And so, like, it's not the same for you. Like, you know, you don't get to, you got to see everything that came after Lockstock and was just doing what Lockstock did.
Yeah, exactly. It's all to say, like this is all in service to, like, please guys, go see this movie on a big screen, because like it works on the big screen. Like, yeah. I loved being in a theater where, like, it big screen images, it works. It bangs it hard as much as like if you watched Abigail and Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare as a double feature, you'd probably get the best smartass movies, like a smartass war movie and a smartass horror movie. Like, if you like that and you like bloody, like, I mean, even then it's like Abigail's a lot more bloodier than Ministry of Warfare is.
Yeah, it's more violent really than bloody. Yes. It's not super bloody.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, but with that, is there anything else you want to quickly cover before we wrap it up for the week?
No, I mean, I finished Fallout, but you haven't finished it yet, so we'll probably talk some more about that next week.
Next week, yes.
And I mean, nobody needs to know my opinion on Fallout. It's already been renewed for season 2. Clearly, it's a hit. I do wonder, like, I wasn't as down on Borderlands as a lot of people seem to be. I did, like, we talked about it when I saw the trailer. I was like, oh, well, somebody saw Guardians of the Galaxy. Post Fallout and how successful it's doing what it's doing, I wonder if, like, can Borderlands succeed, because it's kind of the same idea, kind of, like, you know, from what I see, I've never played the games, but it's a post-apocalyptic kind of thing. I know Borderlands is more like sci-fi-ish. You know.
But it's taking place on post-apocalyptic planets. Right. They've got the similar smart-ass tone.
Right.
Like, they really do. Like, I've played both games, but they're different flavors. Like they're very much so different flavors. Like you said, Borderlands is definitely more Guardians in the way that it approaches things.
Yeah.
And Fallout was always more, we're gonna, like, it's this weird, like, I don't know, like, it's this weird cheery pop style, but hyper violent, like, tone that they play with that I really liked in the games. So yeah, like, we can definitely get into it once I've finished up the series, which will be this week. I just wonder
how Borderlands can, like, how it can exist and people not look at it and be like, oh, Fallout was better. Like, if Borderlands had come out before, it might be like, oh, well, here's a better version of, like, this kind of, like, idea. But now, I don't think that movie can be successful because Fallout exists. So,
all right. But yeah, that makes it exciting for me to delve more into this,
into this series. So we will definitely have a conversation. I can guarantee that we'll have a conversation about it next weekend or next week.
So yeah, go check out everything else we're doing over at xwingfiles.com. And you can read my writing over at Adam's website.
Yes, which I did talk about earlier. We have Back to the Future Part 2 as a part of his about our plural. Okay, so let's try that again. We have Back to the Future Part 2 as a part of Logan's movie pictures column, and it's a great article. Like it's definitely worthy of that. What, like, I'm gonna make it a point to say that I think that Back to the Future 2 is one of the most maligned sequels of all time. Like, it's gotten reassessed, like, as we've gone on, but I still don't feel like it should be where Logan tonally puts it, which is the same as Empire, the same as Aliens, the same as The Godfather Part 2, as a truly worthy sequel. And of course, there's always the context of Ryan and family and personal experience that I really loved about the article. So please read that. That's actually at the top of the page. It'll probably be at the top of the page when this posts. Read my writing on movieisle.com as well.
Yeah. if we only talked about what Adam watched every week, it would just be Adam talking for 3 hours, because holy shit. I do not know how you watch as much as you watch. I remember one year I watched like 500 movies, and I was like, I can never do this again. And you've been doing it for years, and I'm just like, I don't know how you do this, man. Like,
insomnia, baby. Insomnia. Like, that's literally, like, I have to tell you, it's hilarious, but that's literally what it is for me. It's my insomnia. You'd be surprised at how many extra movies you get in with insomnia.
Yeah, when you can't sleep.
Yeah. That's definitely what it is. I mean, I just don't try to, like, I've always told people, I'm like, you know, I don't necessarily just sit in bed and just sit there and, like, look up at the sky or look up at the whatchamacallit. I just literally am like, okay, so let's do this. let's use constructive.
Yeah.
So yeah.
I appreciate that. I was always I just sit and toss in bed insomnia person, and it's not constructive at all.
So. No, it really isn't. And you'd be surprised at how quickly you fall asleep when you're watching something.
Yeah.
Especially if you're like, here's the key to insomnia. I'm going to tell this to everybody and before we let you go. So if you have insomnia, the thing that you need to do is get out of your bed, go into your living room, watch something low-key boring. If you really want to get some sleep, like, you know what, like, the antecedent for me is Star Trek The Motion Picture, the 1979 one. I love that movie, but it is a snail pace. Just watch it in the chair that you normally watch stuff in, and I guarantee you, you will get at least 2 or 3 hours of sleep, which I do. There'll be times where I actually purposely watch stuff because I have the insomnia, but then there's places where I can kind of bump it into sleep, which is like, if you get into your normal mode of doing something, the insomnia doesn't know any better, and you're kind of tricking it into, like, lulling you into sleep. Yeah. And I know that sounds weird and wild, but ask anybody with insomnia, if you try to do something normal, you end up falling asleep. But if you try to go to sleep, good luck.
Yep.
You probably know that, like, you know, playing a video, like it happens to me with video games.
Oh,
like,
when I could have more time for video games, that mm-hmm. that was a big thing for me. Like, playing anything that was expansive, like, that would take time. Like, if it was you know, short little, like, I couldn't play Mario 3 because, you know, those are short little things. But if it was something where I had to wander around, oh yeah, like, I would fucking, like, 15-20 minutes in, I'd be like passed out in my chair.
Yeah. Like, that's what I do. Like if I really want to get to sleep, like, I just try to, like, I trick my body into thinking that I'm doing something that I want to do. And the insomnia goes, oh, that's, you want to do something. Let's go ahead and go put you to sleep. You know, your body sometimes doesn't listen to you, and you got to listen to your body and figure out fun and inventive ways to get around it. And with that, guys, that, you know, we'll be back next week. And like I said, I promise, I fucking promise I will get that done. And we can have an all TV, all streaming like conversation, because we still haven't talked about X-Men 97. And we still haven't talked Bad Batch, fully talked Bad Batch,
yeah,
which I've definitely, all of those things I really want to talk about. So we'll get there, guys.
Sounds good. We will see you next week.
Next week.
All right.
And the Hobbit, number 4 Mario, number 5 Weird Al, number 6 Batman, number 7 Kal-El, number 8 Simpsons, number 9 TV, number 10 every single band that I stole all their MP3s, but before they all sold out, say it all together if you're with me now.